Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Antonin Scalia Law School Federalist Society's final event of the semester. My name is Sydney Dominguez. I'm the chair, and I'm very excited to welcome you all to this event. This event, which is entitled Uncivil War, the Future of Conservative Antitrust with Professor John Yoon and Professor Josh Wright. I do want to make one quick announcement. I did see a question and answer of, unfortunately, can we sue GMU for not having Judd Starr here? He had an emergency meeting, Texas stuff, and we're really thankful to Professor Yoon for stepping in at the last moment, literally just a few hours ago, to speak for this event. We really appreciate both him and Professor Wright for joining us today. Just before we get started, a couple housekeeping notes. If you're interested in joining the Federalist Society, please go to fedsoc.org/join. When you do that, make sure to include Scalia Law as your law school, if you're a student here. That'll give you access to events such as this one. You'll be able to attend a national event such as the Student Leadership Conference, the National Lawyers Convention, which we have been told is gonna be in person this year, as well as being able to participate in our student elections. Just finished up these past ones. And you'll also be able to run for offices if you're a returning student in the spring. Additionally, if you'd like to ask a question during this event, please use the question and answer function. That's the easiest way we can bring everyone in an orderly manner. Other than that, thank you all for joining us again today. I'm gonna pass the microphone off to Chris, one of our 1-hour representatives, who's gonna introduce Professor Yoon, and then I'll pass it off to Evelyn, who will be introducing Professor Wright. Thank you all again for joining us.
Thank you, Sydney. John M. Yoon is an associate professor of law and the director of economic education at the Global Antitrust Institute. Prior to joining the GAI, he was the acting deputy assistant director in the Bureau of Economics Antitrust Division at the U.S. Federal Trade Commission. Also at the FTC, he has served as the economic advisor to Commissioner Joshua D. Wright, as well as a staff economist. His experience includes the analysis of horizontal mergers, vertical restraints, and exclusionary conduct. Over an 18-year career at the FTC, he has presided over a number of high-profile matters and investigations in various industries, including consumer products, retail, intermediate goods, and technology. His research interests include law and economics, antitrust, regulatory policy, and industrial organization, and he has published in academic journals, including the International Journal of Industrial Organization, Economic Inquiry, International Review of Law and Economics, and Review of Industrial Organization. He has also taught economics at Georgetown University, Emory University, and Georgia Tech. He received his BA in economics at UCLA and his PhD in economics at Emory University.
Professor Wright is a university professor and the executive director of Global Antitrust Institute at Scalia Law School at George Mason University. Professor Wright also holds a courtesy appointment in the Department of Economics. In 2013, the Senate unanimously confirmed Professor Wright as a member of the Federal Trade Commission following his nomination by President Obama. He rejoins Scalia Law School as a full-time faculty member in fall 2015. Professor Wright is a leading scholar in antitrust law, economics, intellectual property, and consumer protection, and has published more than 100 articles and book chapters, co-authored a leading antitrust casebook, and edited several book volumes. Professor Wright's teaching interests include antitrust, contracts, administrative law, intellectual property and antitrust, and quantitative methods. He was awarded the Paul M. Bader Award by the Federalist Society in 2014 to an academic who demonstrated excellence in legal scholarship, a commitment to teaching, a concern for students, and someone who has made a significant impact, public impact. Wright previously served the FTC and the Bureau of Competition as an inaugural scholar in residence. Wright's return to the FTC as a commissioner marked his fourth stint at the agency after having served as an intern in both the Bureau of Economics and Bureau of Competition. Wright received his JD and his PhD in economics from UCLA and graduated with honors from the University of California. He is a member of the California NTC Bar.
All right, so I think that means I start, right? So what I thought I would do is, I'm sorry, Judd's not here to have a different sort of discussion and debate that I think John and I will have. And I also want to open up for sort of Q&A and talk to all of you. Judd had an emergency meeting and promised he would come back and make up for it. For those of you who are Scalia Law students, Judd was a Scalia Law 1L who transferred and graduated elsewhere before going on to clerk for Scalia, and now is the Solicitor General in Texas, and is in a unique position because he learned antitrust from me, and I think now is in a and co-authored some papers, and is now wanted to come in on here and fight me a little bit. So we'll get him back, and we'll do that. But I thought what I would spend some time doing is setting a little bit of the stage for what I think is this is, you know, I've been doing antitrust for a very long time, and this is, I think, one of the most interesting moments in antitrust history. I think it's sort of a often gets played as a, you know, antitrust big tech moment, and I think that's true. It's a big part of it, and it's certainly the part sort of driven a wedge in the sort of conservative and libertarian conversation of antitrust. And so we'll end up, I hope, talking a lot about that. But I think the antitrust moment that's happening is bigger than just big tech. And so I thought what I would do, at least to set the stage so that you understand where I'm coming from on this stuff, is spend maybe 5 or 10 minutes setting the stage for what's happening in the antitrust debate right now, because there are a number of different fronts to those ongoing battles, and I think sort of getting a sense of the whole landscape is useful for having the larger discussion. And then I'll sort of shift into what I think are the big moments, the big issues in the conservative side of that debate, or at least how the terms of that debate have been changing for conservatives. So let me do a little bit of table setting, especially for those who may be less familiar with the entire antitrust landscape. So a couple of things, right? You've got part of the ongoing battle. I'll start with the tech cases really, but you've got part of the ongoing battle in the courts, right? So you've got courts, you've got Congress, you've got the agencies, sort of as the three big dimensions, some other interesting things happening, but we'll sort of start there. So there's a lot of litigation pending right now. So most of you, I know because I can see the attendee list, some antitrust students, but if you were to sort of peruse the cases that are already filed and going through the Article 3 system right now, you have got, open your phone and look at the apps and you'll find the defendants, right? So you've got the DOJ has sued Google, and some states are a part of that suit. Those suits, for those of you sort of not familiar, the DOJ suit's mostly about your phone, right? The DOJ suit is mostly about payments that Google has made to either Apple or Android phone makers to take position as the default search engine on the phone. There are some advertising components of those cases at all, but the sort of the big ticket item in the Google cases are about search distribution. The states are a player here too. I don't want to skip too much over the states, because the states are playing a more active role in antitrust than they have in recent years. And so, for example, Colorado has taken the lead in some of the Google cases. Texas has taken the lead in some of the other cases, right? That involve the ad tech market. And they also involve not search distribution, not sort of preferencing to be the default search, but how Google actually structures the results on search engines, right? So these are complaints like, goodness, when I search for a pizza in Arlington and I get a Google map, and MapQuest is mad and complains and says that the way Google has structured its search engine makes it difficult for rivals to compete in spaces where Google is also present. So you have sort of three different buckets of complaint: pure search, if you will, search distribution, and then sort of the ad tech allegations. Google is not the only sort of big tech defendant in those cases. Facebook, you've got the FTC with a 3-2 vote at the commission sued Facebook with really sort of two claims. The less talked about claim is a monopolization claim that says that Facebook has monopoly power in something they describe as the personal social network services market, and that they ought to be sharing their data. They have a policy not to share their social graph data with companies that are rivals and compete against them. Think Twitter, whereas they will share with, you know, third-party apps and the like. So that's one of the claims. The more commonly talked about claim in the Facebook case is probably the one that everyone listening here has heard, which is the attempt to revisit the mergers of Facebook, the acquisitions of WhatsApp and Instagram. So those are acquisitions that the FTC reviewed, ultimately decided not to challenge, you know, roughly a decade ago. Relatively rare, but not unheard of for the FTC to challenge consummated transactions, sort of after the fact. 90-something percent of merger review is done for proposed mergers, you know, before the merger closes. Occasionally they bring consummated merger cases, not very often 10 years after the fact. Usually these are like in rural hospital systems or something like that, where the merger wasn't ever notified to the FTC in the first place. So not unprecedented, but relatively rare. And we can talk about any of the individual cases you want sort of later, but just to sort of keep moving on the landscape. And there's also, I don't know, as many states are exist in the union, there are that many state AGs also suing Facebook. I think there might've been one or two holdouts, okay? So I did Facebook and Google. Amazon has a pending investigation at least one of the federal agencies. Apple gets to play too. So Apple had its own congressional hearing the other day, but also there's some private litigation. So we've got the feds who can sue, the states who can sue, and then private plaintiffs. And there's, you know, the Epic versus Apple suit, sort of an app store allegation over Apple's app store rules. So you've got private plaintiffs, state AGs enforcing the federal antitrust laws, and federal agencies, sort of all plaintiffs in these cases covering Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Apple. So lots of litigation going on. But most of the conversation, I think, that's happening at the policy level isn't really as interesting as those individual cases are. And I'm happy to talk about all of them that you like. You've got a lot of action happening at sort of a broader level, be it rulemaking at the agencies or sort of legislative. Big political wins on the left to do more antitrust, really common. I think there's been a change on the left. So on the sort of left-hand side of antitrust politics, you know, you've got what I'll describe as sort of mainstream progressive sort of keep the existing standard, but the agency should bring more cases, right? It should litigate more cases. It should be more aggressive. That's always been around. The sort of further left side of the antitrust debate, I'll sort of single out Liz Warren and Lina Khan just had her hearing. Tim Wu, I think, just went into the White House, has taken a more aggressive posture. And the claim is generally something like the existing antitrust institutions, and I don't just mean the consumer welfare standard, but sort of all of it, including the legal standards, are broken. And they're broken in a way that means sort of a transformational fix, right? Rather than bringing more cases, giving more money to the agencies that are tweaking around the margins, right? And maybe in Congress, Liz Warren is the most popular, well-known proponent of that position. In academia, you know, no doubt Lena and Tim Wu. And you might notice that out of that group, I named a senator, an academic who's gone into the White House, and another one who's probably going to be confirmed into a seat at the Federal Trade Commission. I think that's relatively new on the left-hand side of the debate, right? That the sort of more populist side of the antitrust debate has sort of been put into positions of power. And I think that's important, but not a huge change. That group's always been there. I think the bigger change has been on the right. And since it's what we're here to talk about that debate, I'll spend a little bit of time there too, and then sort of touch on some of the legislative proposals, or sort of some of what the antitrust debate looks like in light of the rift that's happening. Let me sort of try to identify that rift a little bit first. So I think what's new, and I certainly new for me, is on the right-hand side, if you will, of the competition policy debate. I think Lena's hearing reminded me of my own. I think I was given a little bit rougher of a treatment, but I had a senator described me as the, I think it was the most right-wing thing that had ever walked inside the building on the FTC building on Pennsylvania Street or some such, and I think now in the sort of modern antitrust debate, I feel like I look a lot more moderate than I used to. I think there's been the creation of a sort of a populist right that while probably there, and antitrust is sort of taking a lot more oxygen in the room. And you are familiar and hear this on the right through Senator Hawley, Senator Cruz, and Congress. But you get this sort of increasing angst that goes something like, large tech companies overwhelmingly favor the political left. In political donations, in the way they structure and design products, in how they market to consumers, and sort of all of it, they walk and talk. So goes the complaint, like a member of the political left, they try to influence the government on behalf of the political left. Hey, let's just treat them like the government. Or like part of the political left. And I think one important, we can talk about this as much as you guys want in conversation, but I think an important rift that's happened that's relatively new in antitrust debates on the right is sort of a blurring of the private-public distinction. And that debate happens in other areas of law, but it's not been an important part of the antitrust fight for a very long time, and certainly not at the federal level. Okay, I think that's an important part. You've also got a rise of this same sort of populist right that walks and talks exactly like the populist left. So one of the fundamental claims of the new sort of populist left in antitrust is the consumer welfare standard and the antitrust institutions have failed. They're the reasons we have big tech, and they're the reasons that we have large successful corporations. That sort of joining of the, if you think about the sort of politics in a straight line, this is the joining of the circle of the two ends. Those arguments sort of walk and talk a lot of the same language in some of those claims. So you got some of that in Lena Khan's hearing today, right? A lot of agreement between, at least for the purpose of hearing. And that raises important questions about whether some of the attempts at antitrust reform have a real chance at success, right? Because you've got, you never attracted folks on the right with things like do away with the consumer welfare standard or whatnot. Let me identify before sort of letting John have at me with questions or letting you guys have me at me with questions, a couple of kind of key points of debate that I think are the most important to watch here, and I'll talk some about what I think about them. So, one, the consumer welfare standard itself. There's a lot of debate over it, and not a lot of understanding of where it came from in the U.S. antitrust system, right? So, the consumer welfare standard, if you look at antitrust cases, sort of 1890 to 1977, and I don't even make, there's plenty of my antitrust one students on in the Zoom, and I don't even make you guys do a lot of this. But if you look at those cases and sort of try to identify the goals of the antitrust system, you know, we had an antitrust system that did six things at once. It was, you want to address income inequality, use antitrust, you want to protect small businesses, you want to do consumer welfare, you want to protect national security, agriculture, antitrust can do all your things. And, you know, by the time we got to the 60s, the academic consensus on the left and the right was antitrust not doing a great job of doing anything, made it a little bit of an incoherent, intellectual backwater. It happens to be sitting right next to me. I swear this isn't a planned prop, but Antitrust Paradox came out in 1978. It's really a collection of Bork's articles from the early 70s through 78. Sort of pointing out most of what antitrust is doing is more harm than good to consumers. Supreme Court gets a hold of the law in the 70s and says, antitrust is going to do one thing now. We're just going to do economic welfare. That's it. You can care about income inequality and agriculture and small business. We're going to do those through different vehicles, and antitrust is just going to be about competition. One of the features of the conservative, I think, appeal to antitrust. Antitrust, that big shift was viewed as a success of the conservative legal movement, right? I mean, it was Bork, but it wasn't just Bork. It was our own Judge Ginsburg. It was, Posner and Easterbrook at the time. But it was also much broader than that. The series of decisions that sort of shifted the consumer welfare standard to the consumer welfare standard were, 7-2, 8-1, 9-0 decisions. I think a success of law and economics and a success of the conservative legal movement, in the sense that not only were they sort of led by conservative academics and sort of bringing the rule of law to antitrust that had lacked it, was a powerful set of ideas that persuaded a lot of people across the political spectrum. And I think sort of saved antitrust from itself in a variety of ways. And, we can have lots of debates over the right contours of the edges of the doctrine, but there was lots of agreement in the middle. And I think there still is in at least in academia and certainly among antitrust practitioners, that if you compare the state of the law in the 50s and 60s to, now, the doctrine is sort of much more coherent because it sort of brought in economics to discipline wildly disparate interpretations. Sort of brings us to today's debate. The consumer welfare standard compared to what, right? And I think that this is an important part of the debate for on the conservative side in particular. I do lots of these debates on the left. I do some of them on the right. But I think for conservatives in particular, the idea that, the appeal to getting rid of the consumer welfare standard and the rule of law, this is sort of two edges in antitrust, are two edges of the sort of same sword. I think the appeal for conservatives who are angry at big tech is antitrust is a big hammer with big important remedies. And if what you're looking to do is take a pound of flesh, antitrust can do that. The thing that is stopping antitrust from use that way, and this sort of brings me to another I think a key point on the debate for conservatives. The thing that stops the ability of, I named all those suits, the DOJ, the FTC, the states, and I'm caricaturing for the sake of debate, but conservatives who feel like tech companies have participated, have participated on behalf of the political left and want to take their pound of flesh, the constraint on that is judicial review, right? The constraint on that is Article III courts. And I think a signature feature of American antitrust law compared to Europe, compared to China, is that for plaintiffs to win cases in the US antitrust system, they've got to go to court and show evidence that the harm was bad. As simple as that sounds, that is a relatively unique feature of antitrust in the United States compared to the rest of the world. More presumptions than the rest of the world, presumptions that conduct is unlawful, more bright line rules, okay? By which I mean, if you have a market share above X, what you're doing is unlawful, and far more power for regulatory agencies without judicial review. FTC wants to bring a crazy case to punish Google politically, Google can go to court. Same for Facebook, same for a brick and mortar store, right? Judicial review with the consumer welfare standard are a very important sort of central part of the conservative legal win in antitrust. Part of it was convincing the rest of the world it was a good idea, but bringing the rule of law to antitrust meant constraining agencies against those sorts of applications of the law. So the heart of, I think, the big reforms in antitrust, whether they're conservatives certainly view them as victories, right? It's bringing the rule of law, it's bringing law and economics to antitrust, it's constraint on the administrative state. It's sort of things that conservatives sort of put on the win list usually. Sort of progressives in some instances and in lots of areas, right? It's one of the reasons why I think antitrust sort of until now has been viewed pretty broadly as an area that had dramatic success from, say, the 60s to current. But each of those sort of key features is under attack in the modern debate. Do away with the consumer welfare standard, right? Lots of proposals. And most of the proposals are something either like a vague public interest standard that gives the agencies lots of control, or something like bright line rules of illegality, right? That take judicial review sort of out of the equation or sort of far more out of the equation. In either event, a giant shift of the locus of control in antitrust from Article III courts to federal agencies. That is not a standard on the conservative side of the debate. I think, at least when I talk to conservatives who are struck by the idea that they ought to do something about big tech, my normal response is, well, if you think they've done something anti-competitive, sue them. Sue them and go try to win. The agencies win 80, 85% of their cases. When they have good evidence, they win. When they don't, I mean, that's a win rate a lot of federal agencies are jealous of. It's certainly the current standard's not stopping them from bringing cases now. But if the alternative is, a public interest standard or a standard that gives giant power to a regulatory body, I think that's something that ought to give everybody some reason for concern. The other pieces of the modern debate that I think are important parts of the conversations that conservatives ought to have with themselves about the direction of antitrust is, there's this courts versus agency question that I highlighted, but there's another important part, and then I'll sort of stop and we can just talk. The other important part that I think is critically important for the direction of the discussion. In U.S. antitrust law, I'm in my office at Scalia Law School. There's a famous Justice Scalia opinion in Trinco that I joke with my students. This is the duty to deal opinion in Trinco, for those of you who aren't antitrust people or haven't taken it yet, that provides the legal authority in the United States. You may have heard sort of the sort of slogan that, antitrust law doesn't punish competition or competitors, it punishes competition. The idea is if I compete with you, if I earn monopoly power through building a better mousetrap or a cup of coffee, or it's late enough, bourbon, if I become the monopolist because I outcompete you and I charge the monopoly price, that is lawful in the U.S. antitrust system. I am allowed to compete and win. even if what I do is compete, win, and earn a monopoly. Black letter law, 101 principle of American antitrust law, fairly unique around the world. There are prohibitions of earning monopoly power even by outcompeting in other jurisdictions. Here, Justice Scalia and Trinco, there is what I joke with my students, sort of an ode, love poem to monopoly pricing in that opinion. And not just any monopoly pricing, but monopoly pricing that is earned throughout competing rivals. That kind of fundamental part of US antitrust system, we say if you innovate, you build something better, as a return, you charge monopoly price till entry comes. That's a feature, not a bug, in my view, of the US antitrust system. And I think this is an important part of the current debate, is how everybody, but conservatives included, think about that feature of US antitrust institutions. They are unique. So is the fact that all of those big tech companies, an overwhelming proportion of them, that folks would like to sue or are being sued or what have you, are in the United States. Causation is messy and complicated, and the world is chaotic. And I certainly wouldn't advance the claim that the structure of our US system is the only reason why we have those firms here and not there. But these firms do respond to incentives. And I think that it is a feature and not a bug of the American economy that most of the innovation in these and related markets, not just big tech markets, a lot of it happens here. And I think a regulatory system that embraces the idea that winning a competition is okay, might even be encouraged, is really a key signature feature, along with judicial review, of the US antitrust laws. And those are features that conservatives have traditionally been attracted to in this area. And I think a sort of temptation to take a pound of flesh out of large tech companies in particular is driving a debate to change some of those long-term features. I think I've made it clear that I feel like those most of those changes are misguided. I view a sort of short-term gratification versus really important long-term cost to the American antitrust system and thus to the American economy. I'll stop there. I talked a little longer than I wanted to, and I see there's a bunch of questions in the queue. And so I meant most of that to sort of tee up areas I thought were important to discuss so we can sort of keep talking from there. But John, why don't I let you take first crack at either yelling at me or asking me questions, or we can start working through the queue, whatever you want to do.
Okay. My video is not working, and which is probably better for everyone. There's a welfare benefit right there. So,
Professor Yoon, if you want to I can make you the host again. You can turn your camera, and then if not, maybe just turn off your cameras for the remainder of the event. It'll be all set.
Let's do that.
There you go. You are now the host. You should be able to turn on your camera now.
Great. Okay, thanks. Perfect. Thanks.
And can you transfer it back to me so that
that's happening.
If this crashes, that will.
Okay.
Bad. Awesome. Thank you.
All right. And first of all, I apologize for not being Judd Stone. This is kind of like the Captain America versus Iron Man. We do have Iron Man with Josh, but now you have Ant-Man or someone significantly less important. Okay. Point being, I'm going to get out of the way because these student questions are really good, and we're getting closer to time. So I just have one question. And this question is, you mentioned obviously all this litigation happening, I think somewhat unprecedented in terms of the digital platform space. We have Amazon, we have Apple, we have Google, we have Facebook. All of them are facing to some degree or another litigation. And in a way, this could be quite good for the industry in that, you know, they finally get to prove their pro-competitive arguments, and the agencies will have their day, as you said, to argue for the anti-competitive arguments, although arguably they're under heavy pressure to bring cases. So it's not clear that on the merits they would do it, but for the political pressure, but that's certainly a different discussion. So my question to you is, let's suppose by way of Amex, the digital platforms win and They route the agencies in the states. They prove their case, and under the consumer welfare standard, they're doing quite well. Isn't it a kind of they can't win situation, in the sense that what that's going to do is just raise calls that this proves that the consumer welfare standard is broken? Is there any way this comes out where the agencies, if they lose, everyone just says, you know what, maybe we're wrong about these markets, or is it really going to just ultimately asymptotically lead to more regulation?
So that's a great question, John. And I'm not sorry you're not Judd Stone. So it's an interesting shift in the, I mean, so I left the commission in 2015, and, you know, I voted against more cases than anybody else. But even I, you know, I cared about whether we won or lost. I think the way I viewed winning and losing in court was, you know, the agency had a stock of reputational political capital, and losses diminished it and it hurt our ability to do things I thought were productive. So, you know, there were a handful of cases where I really thought we should lose in federal court, and I rooted against my team, but not a lot. I think the politics have changed a little bit. Commissioner Chopra, who will leave and go to the CFPB, spoke about this as sort of relatively recently and in fairly frank terms. I've heard him say publicly, so I don't mind sharing. Hey, look, let's bring a ton of cases, and if we lose, we'll go to the Hill and have a stronger case for legislative reform. I think for practicing antitrust lawyers in particular, that sounds like someone came down from another planet and sort of came into the field. That's new. Not to say there's not been politics around antitrust. Of course, there has been, but it's been very Article III centric. And I think one of the interesting parts and quite frankly productive parts of this new antitrust debate is, hey, everything's on the table, right? Legislative reform, consumer welfare standard, we'll go from two agencies to one, who knows? Anything could happen. It's the Wild West. And so there's a lot of revisiting kind of first order antitrust questions. I think that's important for any field. And antitrust is having that, as you know. And I think that's a good feature of this kind of conversation. Was I don't care if we win or lose cases. If we lose, we go to Congress and try to make our case. So that I think is relatively new. To answer your question about whether it's sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't, which, you know, my word is not yours, but there's certainly an element of that. But let me sort of, I'll cut to the chase on where I think the politics on this are going. I think for the conservatives in Congress, you've heard there's a lot of angry talk oriented at large tech firms. But if you wanted to change the consumer welfare standard, shift the burden of proof to defendants in merger cases, give civil penalty authority to the FTC. I'm for those of you who don't know or don't follow, I'm naming stuff that's been proposed. You can't do that in a way that limits to large tech firms. Liz Warren's proposal, you know, you can't be the referee and a player or the player and an umpire or something. This is like her Amazon speech for Amazon, who runs the platform and then sells stuff. You can't do that without banning Walmart's private label socks. Or Apple from running an app store, or, you know, sort of pick Netflix from having its original content. I like Netflix shows. You like Netflix shows, right? It's really hard when you have to actually legislate and not talk about your feelings, to do it in a way where there aren't just collateral consequences you and I would care about as an economist or an antitrust person. But they'll care about politically too, because the politics of hurting Facebook are different than the politics of hurting a Walmart consumer. And so I think we're at the part of the game now where we're past yelling about who Twitter lets on their platform and doesn't. We're still going to have that yelling, but it won't just be that. I think we're sort of at the part of the game where if you want to legislate something, if you want to do more than talk about how angry you are, doing that in a way that's surgical in this area, surgical and constitutional, is pretty darn hard. So my own view is you take the House Antitrust Subcommittee as an example. For the House Antitrust Subcommittee, they did a report, and the report said we should overturn every single antitrust case that's been decided since 1977. Every single one, the 9-0s, the 8-1s. You got RBG and Scalia to agree. We're overturning that for sure. In a footnote, 1,024 or something ridiculous, they try to overturn a law review article, which is wild. I'm jealous. I would like my law review articles overturned by Congress. That's a life goal. But when it came to voting out that report, and during you go back and watch those hearings, Ken Buck and Jim Jordan and legitimately, sincerely, genuinely angry at tech companies for what they perceive to either be conservative bias or what have you. I think those feelings are legitimate, whether or not they're well-founded. They are concerned about the way those companies are using whatever power that they have. But when it came to actually, not talking about that in the abstract, but voting for proposals that are legislative and would change the way the American economy worked, that thing was strictly partisan. And strictly partisan, with the Senate structured the way it is, and not being sure you'll get all the Dems on all of these things, I don't think strictly partisan gets you there. So my own sense of this, and you know, I wouldn't bet you more than a beer, but my own sense of this is the transformational antitrust change desired by sort of the left corner and the right corner, I don't think is coming. I think what's coming instead is give the agencies more money to bring some more cases. Tweaks around the margin of burdens and agency structure. Notify more mergers so that sneaky anti-competitive ones don't get through. I think that's going to be a lot more of process and minor substance tweaks. 714 blue ribbon panels will be commissioned. But I'd bet the under on transformational antitrust reform on the politics. No matter if the agencies win or lose those cases, though I certainly agree with the premise that they will be used if the agencies lose. To make the case for more reform. Mind you, on the timing of this, the agencies lose all those cases. We're in 2024. And, you know, politics change. There's a whole new Olympics that have happened. Anyway, that's my answer. John, you want to take me through these questions,
let's start with Alex. Alex has a question about the recent case. I think today, FTC versus AMG Capital on 13B reform. What do you think will happen? Obviously, I think the next move is FTC goes up to Congress directly and asks for some more authority. And what do you think we'll likely see?
I think the FTC was going to Congress before the case. I mean, I think most commentators had this thing sort of pegged to go 8-1, 7-2, 9-0. And so I think they've been gearing up for a while. The 13B issue, just for those not familiar, I think the 13B is the FTC has authority. It lets it get permanent injunctions for conduct that is ongoing. And the FTC over the past 20 something years has expanded that authority to go to court and argue that their ability to get injunctions, permanent injunctions, includes equitable monetary relief. So includes the ability to get money in some subset of cases. We won't do the whole history there, but the short version goes something like the FTC expanded that into a bunch of cases other than sort of straight fraud where they first tested the authority. Circuit split with some circuits questioning the whether that permanent injunction authority meant they could get money. And the Supreme Court coming out 9-0 and saying, you should read the 18-page opinion by Justice Breyer, but saying, you know, injunction don't mean money. And I think it's fair to say that on the commission, and this was certainly my view when I was at the FTC, the ability to get money in straight fraud cases is a good thing for the agency to have. And I think they'll get it. They'll get it back from Congress with some fix. There's important things to talk about to actually write this thing down, the legislative fix, so that they're using that authority in the right set of cases where you don't want them using the authority to get ill-gotten gains from the defendant is, you know, there's a data security case or a privacy case, you know, the hotel you stay at has some data security breach and, you know, I paid $400 to stay in the room and they had some breach, but the measure of damages is the $400 I paid instead of the sort of damage exposure to me from the data breach. I actually got the value. I stayed at the hotel, right? And the FTC has sort of famously gone into court and gone for all the revenue for these companies and had some courts fight back. So I think there's going to be some debate over how to cabinet, what kinds of cases, whether they apply it forward-looking or retroactively. They're going to want to do it retroactively. If that doesn't give conservatives pause, I don't know what will. And how to measure the damages, right? Those are important and difficult. I think we'll see a bunch of hearings, and I think they'll get the authority in a relatively cabined way.
I'm going to move to Kevin Beck's question, and I'll just read it straight. Is there a chance that conservatives, at least the right-leaning politicians, moving in a more populist direction is in some cases better from a consumer welfare perspective, and that it overcomes some reflective support for big business? I think that can go a couple of ways, but I'll just let you interpret it the way you see it.
Yeah, so let me say this. I am, in terms of, when I read, is it better? What I care about is the actual impact in the world of those cases on people, right? I could care less whether the right-leaning politicians are happy, sad, or indifferent to the consumer welfare standard or to big tech or anything else. But in terms of consequences for of a more populist direction, when I think about consequences for that in the real world, all I can do is look at the actual populist proposals that have been made and predict their impact. And things like shifting the burden of proof to defendants for voluntary transactions between two parties, right? It's illegal unless the administrative state says it's okay. That I don't really, you know, I can't think of a good consequence of that. And in terms of the reflexive support for big business, mind you, and I think, Kevin, this is a good question, and you should come take antitrust in the fall. But in terms of this idea, and I get where the question's coming from, sort of, you know, are the conservatives reflexively support big business? Big business is on both sides of every antitrust dispute you can think of. The Google case is Microsoft's to complain it. The Qualcomm case, Apple's to complain it. The Amazon case is Walmart's to complain it. Right? All the other Google cases, Oracle's is the complainant. I don't know. That's a couple $100 billion of market value. There is there's big money on all of these sides. And what we don't want, and I think a point that conservatives largely agree with, is the idea that weaponizing the antitrust system so that it is a way that firms can, I would rather Microsoft and Google compete by making better products that are more attractive to me, or Apple and Qualcomm, or Walmart and Amazon, than spending their resources convincing regulators, be they in the United States or somewhere else, to handicap the rival.
So we have a question from an anonymous attendee. They should have revealed themselves. It's a great question. Or maybe you just typed it in yourself, Josh, sort of doing that. I know that you have a history of that. No. Question. Is it better for the agencies to have very strong sort of policy statements? For example, what's nascent or potential competition? Mm. By the way, I have a paper on that. I'm just saying, coming out in a law review soon. Just letting you know, it's out there. Okay. Is it better for them to be very explicit about what type of behavior is anti-competitive or not, or define things? Or is it better to leave that flexibility to the agency so they can be clearly move in certain directions based on
that's a really good, it's a really good question. You know, so here's my short answer is that, and I'll try to be faster so we can get to more of these, but my short answer is the agency is better off writing policy statements and being transparent about its views of its authority. I think what the agency gets out of that is, and we did this with the Unfair Methods of Competition Authority, where we sort of wrote a statement down where the agency hadn't defined its sort of vague superpower for 100 years. Because what the agency can do, you remember, you know, we've got Article III courts as sort of the backstop against all of this. And for most federal judges, when they get an antitrust case, it's their first antitrust case, their second antitrust case. The agencies get a chance to educate the judiciary about sort of the antitrust framework. And I think if you write, like the merger guidelines, right? If you write down guidelines that interpret your authority in a credible way, it disciplines the agency to be credible and intellectually consistent. And I think it also increases the agency capital, like we were talking about before, which really matters when you go to Article III courts. They believe you. I think the agencies have done that with the horizontal merger guidelines. And I think they've been pretty darn successful in horizontal mergers because of it. I think going the other way puts you in a pretty difficult position in front of a skeptical Article III judge.
So Christopher asks a really sort of broad question, but really a nice policy-based one, perhaps really a 30-minute discussion almost, but are there positives and negatives for the U.S. to have this system where you can extract your monopoly rents, if you will, rather than, you know, extend it, which we don't allow? I think that's the basis of Christopher's question, and if you had any thoughts on that.
Right. So I think what the positives and negatives are pretty clear and agreed upon, and how much magnitude each one gets, there's lots of disagreement, and the answer might be different in different countries. So this ends up being a big, important discussion for international antitrust. So let me just sort of highlight the cost and benefits, Christopher, and I won't talk a lot about the evidence on the magnitudes, but there's sort of big literature here on people trying to think about this more rigorously and sort of provide evidence. But the idea is not too dissimilar from the IP system, right? The idea is, look, everyone agrees that a monopolist reduces the output and raises the price and we get deadweight loss, and that's bad, right? That's a real consumer loss, right? But if I'm competing, if I, you know, that sort of, how did I get the monopoly power? Well, if what I did is burn down the rival's factory, convince the government regulator to give me the monopoly power, whatever, you know, something that we think is reduces social resources, well, all of that's bad. We don't worry about it. We prosecute it. But what if I get the monopoly by sort of innovating? Well, now the monopoly rents are the return on innovation. And innovation is, you know, got giant positive spillovers and is really important for economic growth. Probably more important than static welfare gains. You know, if the price of my cup of coffee goes from $5 to $4.90, I get 10 cents in surplus. And that's real 10 cents. I like my 10 cents. But when there is innovation to change the quality of the coffee, you know, so I'd get really big consumer gains and they're spread across the economy and disseminated to sometimes even other industries. Coffee is a bad example for that, but for other innovations, you get the point. There are these spillovers. And so we've made a conscious choice that the innovation benefits are worth anything we get in terms of the sort of static increase in price. I think there's a consensus view in economics that those dynamic effects are bigger than the static ones. Notice that can cut the other way. If the antitrust allegation is, hey, you engaged in harm that diminishes innovation, well, we should care about that too. And antitrust has to struggle with that and take Professor Yoon's antitrust and IP class.
I know we're right at time, but just these questions are so good. So I think if we have time for one more.
I'll stay until people log off. I don't care. Sydney can tell me the rules.
We can definitely do as many as you guys are up for. We don't have to. The Zoom room will close at like 11:30 at night. Before that, you guys are free to go as long as you like.
We're gonna keep.
Well,
going.
I'm not coming back in at 11. So let's do the questions now.
Good job.
Sounds good.
So I know Christian's is actually has a flavor as Michael. So I'll roll them into one. And it's a really good question. What's sort of the antitrust end game here? There we go with that title. In terms of the U.S. perhaps diverging from the rest of the world, let's say Europe, in terms of how it administers its antitrust system. And what's the ultimate equilibrium if companies obviously have to satisfy all these various jurisdictions? And if they increasingly are becoming more interventionist, what does that mean for the U.S. and what's the ultimate result end game, if you think?
Yeah, and I see in Michael's question part of this, which is, is all this discussion the U.S. is having politically and sort of inside the antitrust circles about kicking the consumer welfare standard, you know, is it likely to render the U.S. less influential in discussions about the international sort of antitrust standard? There, for people. There are 130 something jurisdictions with antitrust laws and probably 20 or 30 that are really important economically that have antitrust laws that all have sort of different flavors. And the US, other countries too, but the US has played an important role for the past 20 or 30 years. It goes around the world and says things like we should have an economics-based system. The plaintiff should bear the burden of showing harm. You can do an economic welfare system, have consumer welfare, total welfare, whatever you want, but we want, you know, an economic welfare based system, pro rule of law, and pro consumer welfare standard relative to sort of other alternatives. And the US has been, you can think of the European antitrust system as sort of playing the foil in those debates internationally. And sometimes the U.S. isn't more influential than Europe, and sometimes it's the other way around. And, you know, if a country wants a short-term political gain, you adopt a really aggressive antitrust system and you tell a company, give me $1 billion if you want to do business here. And that happens. And, you know, antitrust and international trade run together. You know, President Obama sort of wagged his finger at Europe over Apple fines back in the day. You see some of that in every jurisdiction. President Trump's response, sort of oddly, at least to me, was, "Wait a minute, you guys can't sue our tech companies. We can," which was fine, I guess. And so you get some of that, and so it sort of dovetails with those issues of international convergence. I think to the question, I think the U.S. has already lost some standing in international circles. Because of the inability or the sort of unwillingness to continue to take strong stands in those areas. I think that's already happening. There are parts of the antitrust systems all around the world. It's sort of too much to do a lot of examples here. But I think the influence of the US in those jurisdictions is still significant. It is less than it was. I think it it will continue to decline for the time being. So it's a long yes.
Chris has another good question, but let me skip to those who haven't had a chance. So I'm going to go to John. And John asked a really nice question about antitrust cases just taking too darn long. He mentions the IBM case taking 13 years. I think we're doing better now, but is there a fix? And is that a reasonable argument against throwing it to the courts and the consumer welfare standard and your big rule of reason and your war machine of benefits versus costs, Josh Wright? You just want to enrich economic consultants. That's your, no, I've gone too far. So what's your reaction?
Yeah. So it's a great question, John. And I'm glad you brought it up, because I think the time that antitrust institutions take to adjudicate disputes is, while not as politically sexy as are we going to take a pound of flesh out of big tech or not, and who wins and who loses, and do we get to break them up, whatever. Inside antitrust debates, I think this is like an important question. And it's one that's getting some attention. So for example, that Google suit, right? So, you're seeing in political debates, people say, well, wait a minute, why are we going to overhaul the whole system while everybody's getting sued? Like, let's see what happens, right? That Google suit is planned for trial in the end of 2023. They were sued a year ago, okay? These are cases that that's an extreme example of how long to get to sort of off the ground, and presumably there'll be some motion practice and so forth in between now and then, but takes a long time. Getting faster, certainly getting faster. Those are outlier examples. The FTC sued to block a vertical merger, Illumina Grail, recently. Trial set for this summer. I mean, merger cases in particular are going sort of much faster. But I think the speed of antitrust institutions are an important part of the debate. So there are proposals around, Hal Singer has a proposal to do a administrative tribunal for self-preferencing, sort of very cabin type of complaint. He has a standard he wants. He has a way he wants to do it. I think it's a bad idea for reasons we're not going to get into. But I think it's safe to say that there is some thinking going on, I think, inside antitrust institutions and by antitrust academics. Would a specialized court help? Is there something we can do to streamline the litigation process so that we can adjudicate these disputes faster, to take some pressure off of Congress to do something, or rulemaking, or something else? So I think we're in the early stages of that, John. But it is an important debate.
Your answer really brings up that point that this macro policy debate about the antitrust institution as a whole is really sort of as a casualty of that is these more, I think, really important debates about how to make the current system more efficient, and the resources that scholars and various academics and practitioners used to put into this, which they're now being diverted to other areas. So let me move to Kevin's question. So do you think the agencies will continue to bring Section 2 claims against big tech companies to unravel consummated mergers? Is this going to be a trend that's just going to keep going? Or no. Will the Facebook thing, give us some answers there?
I think the answer is no. I mean, and I'll highlight a couple of things. One, I think they're going to lose the Facebook case. The merge, they brought it as a course of conduct claim, and the states have it as Section 7 and they have Section 2, but I think they lose that case on the merits. And losing cases don't start trends. I think they'll do retrospectives and study them and make claims about them, which I think is great. If you want to go back and look at those deals and say, was there stuff we missed? And that's great, because it can inform your sort of future efforts. But I do not think that more consummated deals are going to be a trend. I think it is very difficult to go in front of an Article 3 judge and say, we looked at this transaction, for all intents and purposes, we approved it. I mean, legally, we didn't prosecute, but we reviewed it. We did not prosecute. We waited a decade. And then we sued. We waited till you really integrated the assets that we said you could integrate. And then we sued. Can we win, please, now? Is difficult in any case. I can imagine fact patterns where you could win. A acquires B, that's going to be a competitor, and then buries B, never to be heard of again. That's, you guys all have Instagram and WhatsApp on your phones. It's not buried. It's grown substantially. That does not mean that the FTC can't win. I think it's a difficult case to win, and I think they'll lose it. And I don't think that we'll see much more of that. I think mergers will still be lawful at the end of all of this politically. So I think there'll be new cases.
So Barron's taking us in a slightly different direction. Obviously, Republicans have this concern of being, I'll use the word censored, although I was scolded for using that term one time, on these various platforms. But if a website refuses to carry someone else's speech because of its content, how is that an antitrust problem? What about the First Amendment? And so what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so Barron, I think, knows that he and I are in agreement on this point. So I take it broadly as an invitation to talk about, sort of speech and content moderation and antitrust. I think the law is very clear. A lot of time this discussion happens in the context of consumer protection decisions by the agency, but sort of antitrust too. Content moderation decisions that folks are unhappy with, or speech-related decisions that platforms make that folks are unhappy with, I think are, if people are upset with them, they're upset with the First Amendment, not the antitrust laws, or they're upset with the First Amendment, not Section 230, or what have you. And I think this is sort of a fact of life that conservatives are having a difficult time coming to grips with. And I think it's important because it does drive a lot of the premise of the question is they're angry and they want to do something. And a lot of the reason they're angry are sort of what they perceive to be as, sort of speech related decisions by the platforms. And so there's a lot of sort of heat and smoke politically around those decisions. And man, antitrust is a shiny tool. The rule of law is pretty shiny too, isn't it? Being intellectually consistent is nice and shiny. So is the First Amendment, or at least I think it sort of still is in some conservative circles. Look, I don't think that any, Barron asked about antitrust and the First Amendment. I don't think any of those cases actually get off the ground. I think they're all 12b6, sort of right off the bat. Cases that actually allege content moderation related decisions or, someone kicking somebody off the platform for speech. I think those cases don't go anywhere. They mostly, I think, foment discontent that gets manifested into, well, fine, we're going to make mergers hard for you and everybody else.
So there's another anonymous question, and I hope I'm reading this right. And if I am reading it wrong, I apologize, but it seems to be, why is antitrust not more libertarian? This is refreshing in that this debate used to happen more often than the current one. But the question here is antitrust really having a significant impact on businesses in a negative way? Perhaps some of these arbitrary market definitions, a lot of hyphens involved, innovation that's condemned as predatory rather than actually helping consumers. So were these claims, did they have more currency before the current consumer welfare standard, or are there still larger problems with antitrust as such?
So that's a good question too. Let me think about how I want to answer that. I don't think a lot, here's what I think is new. What I think is new is that antitrust has been successfully turned political for a whole bunch of reasons that would take us a whole bunch. Maybe I would have to stay on till 11:30, which you're just not going to make me do to answer. But I think the success at sort of turning antitrust more both sides, I think, have had some success at attracting more sort of populist interest than they did before. And I think it's a complicated story why. I think in some ways, I mean, you have, I collect these because I need a better hobby, but there are political candidates, not just federal, like local congressmen and state AGs and who run saying they're going to sue big tech or they're going to do antitrust things, even if it's not big tech related. I think on the political left, antitrust has been connected firmly to the sort of the same kind of space that Occupy Wall Street held, yeah, sort of a general anti-corporate populist movement. The right is trickier. I think it is much more big tech specific. I think if you ask some of these questions about the tension between those populist proposals and other values that conservatives purport to hold near and dear, I think at least from the real conservatives, you have actual consternation about it. And I think the most charitable interpretation I can give to that consternation is something like, in some cases where people are persuaded that large platforms have participated in or influenced government behavior, they sort of see the line between public and private in a more blurry way, and they're tempted to do something about it because they're political beings who like winning, because they want to govern and make the rules. And I think that that is understandable. You know, winning's a pretty base instinct. And, you know, I think that's the most charitable interpretation I can give. I think there are people who have sort of good faith reasons to want to adopt populist antitrust views. But I do think the consternation, I take the consternation over it as a positive sign. I mean, politically, it's a huge winning move right now to say you want to sue big tech or yell at them. You see how many hearings we're not getting that because there's no political demand for it. You know, but you're not getting votes on proposals. Maybe that changes, and maybe I'm over optimistic that it doesn't go anywhere. And these moments change fast politically. I think, and you have this in other countries, you have this in places like Europe and even China, when you start making decisions that have negative consequences, people start not getting the innovations that they were promised or that are available or available somewhere else. You have to internalize the cost of know how you feel about it sometimes. And I think I'm hoping we can be lucky enough to avoid that here.
So Ian asks, do we need specialized antitrust courts like in the IP world? Or, I mean, we have the you know, the FTC has its own judges, but do we need to make this an institution?
Yeah. Hi, Ian. And look, I mean, this has been subject of lots of debate. Judge Ginsburg and I have a paper where we stop short of recommending a specialized court, but we kind of discuss the options and talk about some of the appeal to it. I think folks on the left and right have discussed it at various stages. In the case that's generally made is, you know, antitrust is complicated. Who wants to give it to those, you know, silly generalist judges who are going to have an antitrust case for the first time? I've got some skepticism over the benefits of specialized courts. I'll just sort of name them without talking about them. One, we've had a specialized court, the FTC tribunal, full of expert commissioners. I think if you look at it historically, it's both been non-impactful and probably it's been bad. I've got papers on this. You can go find. It's not outperformed generalist judges. Most of the positive evolution in the antitrust laws from the 40s to sort of now have been private antitrust disputes in front of generalist Article III judges. And I like that system. And I don't like all the individual decisions that come out of this system, but it is a common law feature of antitrust that I think where we sort of make incremental gains over time. And you don't have to like every decision to like the system, but I think it's much better than the alternative of sort of administrative regulatory fiat. And specialized courts aren't that, but they're a little closer. If you do it through any sort of tribunal or agency. However, I think the idea of encouraging, facilitating, subsidizing expertise in the courts, or doing something to concentrate cases in front of a subset of federal judges or the like, I think those are interesting ideas. Places we've done that, like the Federal Circuit, most of the, I'm not a strictly patent person, but there's a big literature, most patent scholars, when they look at the literature of what the Federal Circuit does, it's not a great story.
So we got two more left. We're closing in, and thank you to all the attendees. Wow, you guys are sticking around Josh is here, but maybe if it was just me, it'd be down to me. But we're closing in. So Jacob asks about this NCAA case about amateurism and not paying the student athletes, etc. Let me just kind of rephrase it. Josh, if you had to defend NCAA and make the most vigorous pro-competitive argument about amateurism, is there anything you could do there, or it's a losing cause?
I'm on the record saying they're going to lose. So this is hard, but I'll tell you what I think that would look like, so I can at least try to do Jacob's question in the spirit it was asked. So here's the argument that I don't think you can make. I don't think you can say amateurism is an antitrust ends that we care about, and so a restraint promotes amateurism, and some old Supreme Court case says amateurism is good, ergo, we the defendant win. NCAA didn't quite do that, but they did something close to that. And they've essentially said the Supreme Court has held amateurism is good, so we should get deference to decisions where we say we're promoting amateurism. I think that you have to win or lose an antitrust case on antitrust terms. And antitrust terms are about economic welfare and price and output and innovation and the like, right? So the burden on the NCAA is to show that restraints that promote amateurism create demand, right? They create output. People care about watching because of the set of rules that the NCAA has opted that maintain amateurism relative to a world where they don't have those rules, right? That's how we would think about any antitrust case and who bears what burden. If I said, I tell my antitrust one kids when they, students, when they come up with efficiencies arguments and justifications for restraints, they should sort of in their head when they're coming up with those arguments, they should end the sentence with increases output because. And it's a good mental discipline to make sure that you're not just saying something you think is good. It's different to say my merger is going to reduce my costs. My merger could reduce my costs because I'm going to anti-competitively reduce output. I don't have to compete anymore, and that lets me reduce costs. That's awesome. But it's not an antitrust defense. And it's got to be that I'm going to increase output, right? So I think that's what they need to do. I think where they fail is that the evidence doesn't let them do it. I think the real world disagrees with their theory. And when that happens, you lose Section 1 cases.
Well, fair enough. Last question. This is from Christopher again. Look, there are corporations that are taking political stance now, such as Major League Baseball for Georgia's election law reforms. In the long term, is it more important to limit corporate power or state power? And I'll just let you close with that.
Well, he didn't end with a narrow question, did we? All right. That's a good question, Christopher. An important one. So let me say the following. So my view is there's a, for those of you interested, there's a famous article, famous in antitrust anyway. And since John and I are both UCLA Bruins, it's famous in UCLA circles too. An economist named Harold Devsetz, who wrote an article called Two Systems of Belief About Monopoly. And the fundamental point of the article, it's, you should go read it. But the funda, and it's written in the late 60s, early 70s. But I think a lot of the debates we're having in antitrust now are exactly the debates that we had in the 60s and 70s. It's sort of a, you know, a lot of the ideas that were in vogue in the 40s, 50s, and 60s are sort of coming back to the antitrust debate now. So in any event, that's sort of the ball game. And I think one of the most important ideas then, and Demsetz wrote about this sort of most famously, was the economic idea that public restraints of trade, that government power was anywhere and everywhere more dangerous than private power, including corporate power. That's my view. That remains my view. From an economic perspective, if we just sort of, I'll sort of answer in the antitrust sense first, because that's what we're talking about. But in the antitrust sense, you know, I build a better mousetrap, cup of coffee, you know, blend of bourbon. And I succeed by, I get monopoly power because I outcompete all of your nasty tasting coffee and bourbons. And I get 100% market share and I start charging a monopoly price because the market will bear it and I can. Right. The cost are, you know, there's real social cost imposed by the monopoly. But over time, the monopoly price attracts entry, people compete, they substitute away, innovation happens. There are constraints imposed on private power that simply have no analog for in the world of government power. And we'll sort of ignore all the big metaphysical stuff like the government has guns and stuff, right? Those are important metaphysical issues, but just in turn, you know, the government granted monopoly is more persistent. There's no natural forces that tend to minimize it, and antitrust institutions are sort of consistent with that. One of the most interesting wrinkles in the current politics over antitrust and somewhere in the GAI discussion series, you guys can go look this up. It's on the YouTube page somewhere. And I have a discussion with Matt Stoller, who is a leading voice in the more populist sort of lefty antitrust crowd. One of the places where there used to be very clear bipartisan consensus at the FTC and elsewhere was government supported monopoly was bad and we should stop it. This gave conservatives some pause because it was, you know, federalism versus antitrust, right? It was, when can we use the federal antitrust power to override a state decision to create monopoly? Frank Easterbrook wrote a lot about this in academic work. The answer was sort of, well, when the state does something either not accountable because you can't vote to fix the decision, or there's spillovers to another state, right? And so they're sort of imposing negative externalities on sort of folks that are outside of the political regime that voted for the anti-competitive rule. But there used to be bipartisan consensus. A taxi cab commission passing rules to exclude Uber was bad, and we ought to sue the taxi cab commission or at least write them a nasty letter or something, right? That used to be, you know, 5-0 easy FTC vote, furthest left and furthest right sort of agree. And I think the FTC actually did a lot of good work along these lines. You know, state rules that, you know, prevent a dental hygienist from practicing or whatever until, you know, the dental board is happy with her, what have you. So that's changed in the current politics. So a lot of those populist progressive groups take the view that monopoly is bad everywhere unless it's created by the state or a local government. And that doesn't get a lot of attention yet. They're open about it. I don't know why it doesn't get much attention. I think sort of big tech takes all the air out of the room is the answer. But there's a lot of state and local monopoly, you know, occupational licensure and, you know, state permission to work is like 60% of the economy or something like that. But their view is largely keep antitrust out of state decisions to create monopoly, which is interesting. I think it's wild and probably misguided. But I think there's the big debates that we're having, I sort of didn't include on my original list, sort of state versus private power as the main threat. It's, you know, it's an analog to this point about sort of the public-private distinction, but it is a separate point. And I think I'm glad that we ended on this one because I think it is important. I think we're seeing a whittling away of the consensus view. One place where you could get conservatives and sort of liberals together on antitrust was a state law suppressing competition was a bad thing. And I think there's been a whittling away of that in a way that I think is unfortunate. And it's new. The Obama administration put out a report, sort of one of the most aggressive antitrust reports about occupational licensing and wanting the feds to go after it and so forth. And that's taken a really quick turn with the sort of populist wing on the left. And I think that, I guess I'll just say for now, remains, I think, an important space to watch to see whether the FTC in particular, under its new leadership, will sort of continue to play there. My view, so that I'm not ducking the question, is it sure should, because state-granted monopoly is an important and probably the most important source of monopoly power in the economy.
With that, Josh, thanks so much for your time tonight. Thanks for the Federalist Society for hosting it. I'll throw it back to Sydney, and thanks for all the attendees and great questions.
Of course, and I want to give a big thank you to Professor Wright and Professor Yoon for making the last event of our semester really wonderful, really awesome. With that, if you guys don't have any final comments, we'll go ahead and close out the event.
Take care. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you both. And thank you to everyone who attended tonight. Have a wonderful night.